Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Zimmerman, and I represent the appellants, United Services Automobile Association, and USAA General Indemnity Company. At the heart of this case are two competing interpretations about how to calculate the actual cash value of a total loss vehicle in Louisiana. USAA believes that based on its policy language and based on the governing statute, it must determine the actual cost to purchase a comparable motor vehicle, which necessarily requires consideration of the unique condition and features of the lost vehicle at issue. All of the evidence in this case shows the vehicle's value depends on its unique condition. Plaintiffs offer a contrary interpretation of the statute, though not the policies, suggesting that any valuation referenced in the governing statute, LARS 22-1892-B5, can establish the actual cash value of a vehicle as a matter of law, irrespective of the unique condition or features of that vehicle.
Well, let me make sure what you were presenting to us about what Judge Kane, how Judge Kane left us. I thought the import of his decision, you disagree with the starting point, but I thought he still allowed adjustments to the value based on actual condition. You were disputing how he allowed that or how it would proceed in doing it on a class-wide basis. Is that correct?
So I think importantly, Judge Kane's opinion did not actually reach a factual finding as to whether CCC's condition adjustments can be applied on top of NADA values. This is page 17 and 18 of his opinion. He sort of cited all of the contrary evidence that USAA presented in the record and said, well, this is an issue we don't have to address. This is a merits issue that we can kick to a later stage. And USAA believes that that's a legal error, because without a finding that CCC's condition adjustments can be lopped on top of NADA values, there's no common proof, there's no generalized proof, there's no common evidence in the record to establish.
Those are important arguments, but let me just make sure, didn't Judge Kane recognize the need to try to evaluate or determine what the actual condition of a vehicle was insofar as determining? You say he's not doing it the right way, and he's also doing it as a matter of damages and not a matter of liability and whether a person's a proper class member at all and whatever mm-hmm. else, but he did recognize the need to try to determine the actual value of the total vehicle before the damage.
Yes, we think that's right, Your Honor. And this is actually clear from the transcript there as well. Judge Kane, and we cite the transcript portion in a footnote in our brief. I believe it's footnote 4 of the opening brief. Judge Kane says to plaintiff's counsel, well, I didn't take you guys as coming in here and suggesting that you only get not a clean retail without adjusting for condition. And plaintiff's counsel said, yes, you're right. And Judge Kane confirms, yes, you know, because we have to account for the unique condition of each vehicle.
Well, I slowed you down. Why don't you move on?
Apologies.
But so, okay. Judge Kane did seem to be relying heavily on Slade. And to my knowledge, the argument you're making now is one that was addressed by Slade. I saw your brief as suggesting at least three, maybe more reasons to reverse. One was a standing question. Two, I can shorthand as saying NADA values, NADA values, that's arbitrary. Mm-hmm. The third is the one you've begun with, but I thought the third was pretty decided by Slade.
So I can give Your Honors four reasons here why I think Slade is not controlling, and I'll start with that position
but
first.
But what's your primary argument for reversing? What is the legal error that the district court made in certifying this class?
The legal error the district court made is that it found commonality and predominance satisfied based on a single question of statutory interpretation that does not establish liability for any single class member. Both the elements of the causes of action alleged by plaintiff and the Article III standing analysis require each class member to show an actual injury, an underpayment.
And you're saying by selecting NADA, that's arbitrary because there are other recognized standards that might have been less, therefore we don't know if there's an injury. Is that essentially your argument?
Correct, Your Honor. I think there's two components to it. One is that NADA, correct, does not establish the actual cash value of any given vehicle. It gives a generalized benchmark price, and USAA believes that both its policies and the statute require consideration of the unique condition
and
features of the
vehicle. And I'm assuming he said he'll get to those unique conditions later if he needs to, and that he thinks he can do pursuant to Slade. So I'm sort of lopping off the first part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even if that's true, that he can, the class is good, and that's sort of, he gets great deference as to sort of damages. Oof. The legal error of selecting NADA alone.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this gets to the distinguishing, the difference between the record in this case and the record in Slade.
Okay.
What Slade said was based on the evidence presented in that case, the court said there was no principled reason why WCTL's condition adjustments, which a different product and, as I'll explain, different condition adjustments, couldn't be applied on top of NADA values. And in this case, the record contains testimony from CCC itself, testimony from an independent expert, and testimony from NADA itself saying, no, 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 if you take CCC's lost vehicle condition adjustments and put it on top of NADA values, that's not going to produce accurate vehicle values. One of the reasons for this was discussed by the district court opinion in Prudhomme, which postdated Slade and had the sort of benefit of knowing what Slade held. And what the court said in Prudhomme was that the baseline of the condition adjustments in this case are different than the baseline of the condition adjustments of the WCTL product. The WCTL product.
But in Prudhomme, this district court sort of dodged around Prudhomme, published or unpublished, saying
correct.
The class can only be those people that weren't paid. According to CCC, they were paid less than any guidebook that...
That's not what the district court did, Your Honor. The district court limited the class to individuals whose CCC base value was less than NADA base value.
My question for you, given that, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. What guidebook would you concede is a legally acceptable one?
We think the guidebook's values are a starting point, and that's what the guidebooks themselves say. That's what all of the evidence in this case says. Whether you're using NADA or KBB or Manheim Market Reports or an electronic database like CCC, like WCTL, you have to consider the unique condition and value of the lost vehicle at issue. Because neither NADA nor KBB nor any other guidebook purports to give the unique value of a vehicle at issue.
Okay. All right. Well, your argument is coherent throughout. It's resisting my premise, so my premise may be wrong. CCC seems to be internal to USAA. So therefore, it's very hard for me to think that it qualifies as 1892, generally recognized. Then I'm really wondering, what's the limited orbit of generally recognized guidebooks?
That's kind of a legal question that's out there. And there's a number of guidebooks that could fulfill the statute. And that's why even if plaintiff's theory is correct, that any guidebook referenced in the statute establishes actual cash value as a matter of law, that doesn't solve the predominance issues here. And it doesn't solve the adequacy issues either. Because there's going to be
It doesn't solve the standing issue either, right?
And it does not solve the standing issue. And your eyes, Your Honor, knows standing was not addressed in Slade. Slade was decided before TransUnion, and the Supreme Court's opinion in TransUnion said two things. One, before we get to a judgment on the merits, every class member has to show standing, irrespective of the class action
TransUnion
advice.
TransUnion did adopt and reinforced AMCAN. So the way I read those two cases, the Supreme Court's still saying focused on the named plaintiffs.
Correct. I think the way to look at TransUnion in the class certification setting is the way that the 11th Circuit's done it in Cordoba and also has subsequently applied it in Drazen v. Pinto. The 9th Circuit intimated this as well in it's Olin v. Bumblebee. What they say is that the standing analysis really raises predominance problems because at some point before a judgment on the merits, we're going to have to determine which class members were and were not harmed. And in this case, that means determining which class members were or were not underpaid. And the only way to do that under USAA's theory of the reading of the policy is to look at the actual unique condition and value of the vehicle. And the only way to do that under plaintiff's reading of the statute is to have these mini trials about every other possible generally recognized used motor vehicle industry source
I would have
or
thought
fair
the
market
same
value.
Question in a class case would be we'd look at the named plaintiffs. Now you may say your argument still stands as to them.
We've not contested the named plaintiff standing in this case, though in our summary judgment briefs, we say based on the proper guidebook value, they weren't actually underpaid. The summary judgment briefs have not yet been resolved by the district court. But I believe that the standing issue still does raise important predominance problems.
Well, Samson, for example, what did he lose under the value according to NADA would be what?
I don't recall offhand, Your Honor,
Let's
Mr. Samson.
$6,700. And according to CCC, your measure, it's $5,900.
Now, that doesn't necessarily establish injury because plaintiffs don't say.
So why are you conceding standing as to a named plaintiff? That doesn't establish injury.
So, Your Honor. Let me say, at this point of the case, plaintiffs have alleged standing to get to the class certification point. They've alleged an underpayment. And what we're saying that there's not actually an injury for plaintiff Sampson or any other class member because we'd have to look at any other possible permissible guidebook to see whether that individual was underpaid.
And how hard would that be?
I think
we'd have to, so there's a finite set, Kelly Blue Book. Let's just go through the finite set that Louisiana law accepts, and if CCC was less than the lowest.
So two responses to that, Your Honor. One is that it's not just guidebooks. The statute references any generally recognized...
That's why I keep asking you, where do we find the finite set?
I don't think that has been defined, and I think that's important. The reason that the Louisiana legislature hasn't defined the finite set is because the purpose of this statute isn't to say, you get NADA, you get Kelley Blue Book, you get Manheim Market Reports. The underlying purpose of the statute, and this is the introductory phrase of the statute, it compels insurers to pay the actual cost, to pay a comparable motor vehicle. That's consistent with the decades of Louisiana precedent that predated the statute, which recognized that, you know, guidebooks don't set the specific value of a vehicle. And even when a guidebook is something you can look at to value a vehicle, the Clark v. McNabb case says, well, it's a question of fact as to what the most appropriate guidebook is. In some situations, NADA may be more accurate than KBB, might be more accurate than Manheim Market Reports. And the point of all this is also the point of sort of insurance itself. And this is the Paley v. Munoz case from the Louisiana Appellate Courts. It says that insurance compensates for loss. Loss is the actual value of the vehicle in this case. If NADA is providing a generalized benchmark price that doesn't sort of establish the actual value of the vehicle, then we're creating perverse incentives as well, because, you know, that means insureds can generate value for their vehicles that are much higher than the actual guidebook or the actual value of their vehicle itself.
That sounds to me like you're pushing against Slade, which is fine.
I am pushing against Slade, Your Honor. I'll quickly say four reasons why I think Slade is not applicable to the case here. First, Slade did not address the adequacy issue here.
I agree.
Second, Your Honor, Slade did not actually address the underlying predominance problem here. Slade commented on the Comcast fit between plaintiff's liability theory and plaintiff's model of damages. It sort of assumed that the liability theory was correct. And after all, Slade reversed the district court's opinion, so we can't read it as sort of implicitly affirming anything it didn't discuss. What Slade did not address was whether there was a generalized theory of proof to establish to which class members USAA, or in that case Progressive, was or was not liable to. That's required by this court's precedent in Gene and Gene v. BioPay. And fourth, Your Honor, as we discussed earlier, I think the record in this case is fundamentally different than the record from Slade. The Prudhomme District Court point I mentioned earlier is that the condition adjustment of the WCTL product started from what's called a dealer-ready vehicle, a vehicle it's they called it 3.0, other sources call it dealer-ready, USAA calls it very good. That's the same condition of baseline that NADA uses. CCC starts from a different condition baseline. They start from a good condition baseline. So, for example, if my vehicle was in dealer-ready condition, if it had been recently detailed, new tires, et cetera, what CCC is going to do is they're going to start from the baseline of good, and they're going to give me an adjustment to bring my vehicle up to dealer-ready condition, which is where WCTL and NADA start. And that shows why you can't just take the CCC condition adjustment and lop it on top of NADA, because it'll be double counting.
You had your chance in front of the district court to say infeasibility, and the district court points to experts and say, we can do this in 2 minutes.
The experts did not say, all that the experts said in this case is, I can take the numbers and I can add and subtract numbers. The experts did not discuss whether it was legally or factually appropriate to apply CCC's condition adjustments on top of NADA values. I deposed plaintiff's expert in this case, and I asked her, you know, what support do you have? How do we know this is going to produce accurate vehicle values? And what she said is, I'm not here to offer that opinion. The only opinion I'm offering here is, you could take this number, you could take that number, and you can add them together. That's the only opinion that plaintiff's expert offered. Your Honor, I want to address one... I want to address one quickly remaining point, seeing a minute left here. Plaintiffs also repeatedly assert in their brief that these are negative expected value claims, and that the only class certification is necessary here to sort of enforce the purpose of the underlying statute. That's the only way we're going to enforce the statute. There's two problems with that, Your Honor. First, the bad faith statute here permit the recovery of attorney's fees, and as this court recognized in Castano v. American Tobacco, a case is not negative expected value if you can recoup attorney's fees, because then you can recoup the entire cost of litigating the case. And as the court also said in Flesh v. Metacredit, the negative expected value sort of inquiry is only pertinent to the superiority analysis. It doesn't obviate the need to show predominance, to show adequacy, or to show any other Rule 23 factor. And what the court also said in Flesh v. Metacredit is that fear of under-enforcement of a right is not justification for class certification. Plaintiffs must affirmatively demonstrate compliance with Rule 23, irrespective of this sort of underlying enforcement of the right. In Louisiana state court, enforcement of a right is a policy rationale for enforcing class certification.
You want to give 30 seconds to Sultana?
Yes. So four things about Sultana. One, we think it's waived. They didn't cite it to the district court. Two, doesn't address standing at all. So to the extent that there is a 1973 sort of right to relief in Louisiana state courts, that doesn't obviate the Article III standing issues that each named plaintiff or each class member will have to show. Three, Sultana addressed a different part of the statute. The sort of underlying bad faith itself in Sultana didn't require an underpayment. The underlying bad faith here, which is subsection B5 of the statute, does require an underpayment. It's the failure to pay the amount of any claim due. And the last point, Your Honor, is Sultana didn't address, and subsequent Louisiana cases still say, no, you still need an underlying breach of contract to get to bad faith penalties. Sultana, there was, they breached the insurance contract and had to pay and then subsequently settled that litigation and then failed to pay that settlement. Here, for any insured who wasn't underpaid, there's no breach of contract.
You got a lot in there.
Thank you, sir. Apologies for talking fast.
Your Honors, I'm going to begin by addressing the negative value issue because it was an issue that was never raised in the underlying court, nor was it raised in their briefing. They talk about how we're precluded from talking about Sultana, and I'll talk about why we're not later, but they shouldn't be able to raise this negative value issue at all. In fact, Judge Kane noted in his opinion that they did not contest that this was a negative value claim. So this is a negative value claim, as far as the record is established, as far as Judge Kane has found, and that is entirely within his discretion.
I thought Judge Kane limited the class to a negative value.
Well, what Judge Kane did was Judge Kane limited the class to people whose NADA value, clean NADA retail, was less than the unadjusted CCC base value. What Judge Kane said was, you're starting at the wrong point, or rather, this is what plaintiffs said. Plaintiff's whole lawsuit is not about condition, it's not about individual vehicle values, it's not about prior loss. They talk about, oh, well, plaintiff's gonna overcompensate it because what if somebody has a junker and they get NADA value? Well, you know, they shouldn't be able to get that. That's not what this case is about. Louisiana law says that if you're gonna use a guidebook to start, you gotta start with a guidebook that is generally recognized. They're starting at the wrong value.
But am I right that Louisiana law also says that NADA is not the required valuation?
That is correct. There are multiple allowed valuations.
Do you agree
presumably
with opposing counsel that there's nowhere will we find what the finite limit is? Do you agree with him on that point or not?
Well, I think it's a question of fact. This ultimately got to be resolved by the trier of fact. Certainly, we're going to suggest NADA. We don't accept the proposition, by the way, that they make, that an insurer can go and pick and choose whichever is best from them. For them.
I know you were very strong in the brief about that, but it's not intuitive to me that an insurer in its contract wouldn't be able to rely on the least valued legal method.
I don't think that would be, I think that would just be a violation of general concepts of good faith and fair dealing. But let's assume that they can.
Yeah.
Let's assume they can. They have the ability. This is a class action trial on a model. They have ability to attack the model. They have the ability to come and say, you know what? You're wrong. CCC for some of these folks would be less.
And we know we know some of them, 9%, got more than the Kelly Blue Book. Is that correct?
Correct.
So those people, why would they be appropriately in the class?
Well, because they can allege at this point, and remember, standing is based on, assuming that we even have to have standing for absent class members. But standing is, as Judge Southwick noted under Lujan, it's decided based on the status of litigation at the time. Those people can certainly allege, and it has not yet been decided, that NADA or CCC is the appropriate vehicle for them. If there are some people for whom CCC and NADA is less than, KBB and NADA are less than CCC, well, those people, they don't have a problem at all.
And I'm going to let you go into the argument because it's complex and I sometimes ask too many questions. But just as to the named plaintiffs, is there any way that we can be sure that Samson himself wasn't given more than, say, Kelly Blue Book?
Well, there are two named plaintiffs. First of all, there's Samson
and
Fagan.
I'm just picking him out because then I'll just stay fresh.
I believe that I'm not sure that the record actually addresses because I don't think that the defendants addressed it in the lower court.
But wouldn't we have to confirm ourselves as to standing, as to the named plaintiffs? Wouldn't we have to?
Well, again, he's got standing because at this point it hasn't been decided whether NADA or KBB are the appropriate benchmark
valuations.
But we know
Louisiana law says that NADA isn't required.
But NADA is one of the allowed.
It is.
And we know that what they have done is wrong. Not to mention, getting back to, now we will go to Sultana, we certainly have argued in the lower court that injury is not an element of a claim for bad faith under 1892. It is our position that,
Did the district court even cite Sultana?
It cited Oob, which is actually a later case than Sultana, and that may frankly be a mistake on my part in the briefing. I went to the seminal case, Sultana. Oob certainly followed Sultana. The lower court cited Oob, which also reinforces the Sultana.
Did you cite Sultana below to the district court?
I don't know if I did or not, but I'm the appellee, Your Honor. They raised this issue on appeal, and we cited Sultana in response to their issue, to their assertion that there was no injury. In the lower argument, argued.
Is it fair to say that you agree that as to your contract claim, there has to be injury? That's an element of the of liability.
I don't actually.
You don't?
If you look at the recent holding in Dennings versus Bond Pharmacy, which is a Fifth Circuit holding, the mere breach of contract is a violation, is an injury in fact for standing purposes, and here. Louisiana law requires that the contract be modified, and this is cited in our papers. The contract has to be modified to include the requirements of 1892. So if they're violating 1892, they're in breach of their contract. And that in itself is an injury, according to the Fifth Circuit in Dennings versus Bond Pharmaceutical. Also, they're following a Supreme Court case that was handed down just before TransUnion. And I'm going to butcher the pronunciation. I think it's Uzabagian, but it's cited in the Dennings case. standing, I don't think, is even gets to be an issue in these cases, because certainly all of these plaintiffs had the harm occasioned on them of starting at the wrong point. They started with an unlawful value. They breached the terms of the contract. If they were going to use a database system such as what they chose to use, it had to be a generally recognized used motor vehicle industry choice. And, you know, we had some discussions about the purpose of the statute. Your Honors, the purpose of the statute is to keep insurance companies' thumbs off the scale. And what they are doing is putting their thumbs on the scale by using all these algorithms, using these numbers to start with. Not even talking about condition adjustments, but just the starting point. What is the value of a retail vehicle? What is the retail value of a vehicle? They're starting with a number that they have generated. CCC, a company that is employed exclusively by insurance companies. No consumer can even use it, access it. That's what the statute's for, and that's what we're complaining about, is that they have violated the terms of their contract.
So they contracted to pay you actual cash value. The vehicles are totally lost, and you're saying they shortchanged you because they use an internal methodology that undercuts any recognized source. That's basically your class theory argument. And then if they're differentials following Slade, that's a damages issue, and the district court gets a lot of deference.
And if they are able to say, okay, for instance, for 9.2% of the class, they say that KBB is lower than CCC. If that's a viable defense, they can raise it on summary judgment, and those people will get their claims dismissed. But that doesn't mean that they don't have standing, and it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be in the class. Certainly, those people, at least at this point, can articulate an injury.
I'm still stumbling over Samson, because this is the numbers I remember. If Samson actually got more than another recognized Blue Book, I'm not sure I see how he has injury.
Well, I don't know that Samson did get, I don't even know if it's in the record, Your Honor, as to whether or not Samson got above CCC.
I'm pretty confident he got 5,900. You say that he should have gotten 6.7, citing NADA. But what if the Kelly Blue Book value was 5.8? He wouldn't have an injury, would he?
They didn't raise that in the lower court, Your Honor. I don't think it's appropriate to address it now.
Okay, but why if it's a standing issue, if there's no injury, it has to be raised in order to confirm that he's a proper litigant representing the rest of the class.
Your Honor, the thing is, he does have standing, at least he can allege at this point. The only showing that's been made is NADA. It's certainly lower than NADA. They haven't refuted that there's some other system that's lower. Remember that we analyze standing according to the status of the litigation at the point where we are when we're asking the query. Right now, There's been no motion for summary judgment. He may lose on standing.
They've refused throughout to ever identify any legally recognized? Is that what you're saying?
They have not said there is a legal number for Samson that is lower than CCC. Okay. They haven't said that. They haven't put forth any evidence to that effect. We have shown that there is a legal number that is higher than CCC, and hence Mr. Samson is injured. Now, if they come along later on summary judgment and show, well, actually, you're wrong, there is a legal level that's lower, then Mr. Samson will lose on summary judgment because that's the appropriate stage to analyzing standing at that point. And we may lose our class rep, one of them. I don't think we'll lose Ms. Fagans because Ms. Fagans, the differential was several thousand, well over $1,000 in Ms. Fagans' case.
So it's just a question of sequencing, and this isn't an issue that Slade addressed, correct? Slade covered a lot of ground, to my memory, much of it in your favor, but no one had presented this arbitrariness argument to the Slade panel.
Well, in Slade, the question was KBB or NADA.
Right.
And the court said, well, you can look at KBB or you can look at NADA.
Right.
Again, I would say that comes down to a question of this quote arbitrariness argument comes down to a question of merits. It's going to have to be resolved as a question of law. One is, can they pick and choose? Can they pick whichever one's lowest? And if that gets resolved against certain plaintiffs, and then they can make a show.
What's the best authority that an insurance company can? I thought that's exactly what the contract specified.
The contract doesn't say anything about what methods they can use.
But why wouldn't they be entitled to give actual cash value legally recognized, albeit smaller than others? Why? Under what logic wouldn't they?
Because, Your Honors, it would be, our position is that it would be arbitrary and capricious to go and pick whichever guidebook is lowest.
Okay. Keep going.
You know, but if they raise that, and if they're right, and if they can show there are other valuations for some small percentage of the class, so far they've shown it's at most 9.2%, then let them raise it on summary judgment. Those folks will lose.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean they don't have standing at this point.
Stop answering mine. Go ahead.
Your Honor, the rest of this, this comes down to a question of discretion of the trial court. I remember I was arguing the Prudhomme case. And I was saying, how under Slade can Prudhomme be right? And a member of that panel asked me a very appropriate question. He said, isn't it possible that under the broad discretion of the trial court, Prudhomme could be right in finding under its discretion that certain elements were not satisfied, and Slade could be right finding under certain elements that predominance, adequacy, et cetera, are satisfied? And that was a question to which I have to be honest, I didn't have a very good answer. And that's why I think we lost in Prudhomme, was because it came down to the discretion of the lower court. The lower court exercised its discretion here in first, identifying a common issue, and I think Slade certainly established that there is a common question as to whether or not they're violating the statute. Are they starting at the right number? Then we go to is adequacy of representation. Now, Slade found that we actually remanded on the question of adequacy because of plaintiffs' decisions to limit their claims in the way that they had. Judge Kane addressed that issue of adequacy of representation following the rules that were laid forth in Slade. That was entirely within his discretion. Finally, you come down to predominance. And following the rules that were laid out in Slade, and by the way, predominance was one of the biggest issues contested in Slade. The opinion only addressed Comcast because that sort of seems to be where the sticking point was for the court. But remember that the court in Slade, Your Honor, I think was the author, pointed out that for the reasons espoused by the trial court, we find that the rules, the requirements of Rule 23b2 are met, with the exception of, and then went into the discussion of adequacy of representation that I just covered. So Judge Kane here was certainly within his discretion in determining that, just as in Slade, the requirements of Rule 23b2 had been met. Now there's this question of, can we apply the condition adjustments of CCC to NADA values. Well, that comes down really to, is the model correct? So I do think it's a merits question. But to the extent that there's a question whether or not you can do it, I think Judge Kane, well within his discretion, relied on, or rather determined that issue in favor of plaintiffs and said, okay, to the extent that I've got to consider condition, and by the way, I'm not sure that I do because that's a contested issue in this case, but to the extent that I do, plaintiffs say they are going to accept the condition values at their face value. Here is what the CCC report says about its condition adjustment. The CCC report says CCC makes dollar adjustments that reflect the impact that the reported condition has on the value of the loss condition compared to good condition. We're accepting that at face value. Judge Kane said we're entitled to accept that at face value. He did not accept their witnesses' explanations that you can't do that, that that would be inappropriate. Yes, their witnesses did say that. But if you read the full testimony, when they're asked, why did you say that? Why do you say that? Their response is basically, because reasons. They don't have a very good explanation of why it is that we can't rely on what these guys have said is the difference between the lost vehicle condition and a regular vehicle on the road. And Judge Kane apparently accepted that and, in his broad discretion, affirmed certification. There were some issues raised in the briefs, Your Honor, that were not addressed in my opponent's argument. I can address them, but if you're not interested, I'm happy to sit down.
If you're happy, I think we'll be happy.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. So first, starting with this multiple value issue that there's, under plaintiff's theory, any statutorily referenced valuation method establishes actual cash value as a matter of law. What they said is, well, you can come and just litigate that as to Arthur Sampson, and we can determine whether he was underpaid. The predominance issue in this case is that that same litigation will occur for each and every single class member. Every single class member, there will be a mini trial as to if there's a question of fact as to the best valuation source, what the best valuation source was for that individual, or if any permissible source establishes ACV, which is plaintiff's counsel's contention, then there'll be a mini trial as to whether the individual was paid more than any other statutorily permissible source, which is more than just guidebooks. It includes a fair market value survey, too. And we can envision all kinds of litigable issues about, oh, well, if we went back in time and did this fair market value survey.
Counsel, if you ever decide you don't want to practice law, I think FedEx will hire you for that speed talking. Would you please
apologies, Your
down?
Honor. I'll slow down. Apologies. If there's going to be an individualized mini trial as to each insured as to whether or not they were paid more than the actual cash value of the vehicle, that destroys predominance. There's no generalized proof. There's no common evidence that triggers a yes-no liability for each member of the class.
Well, it just might mean you'd have a bunch of different classes. But why isn't USA obliged to say, as to any legally recognized theory, here's the dollar amount?
If this court comes out and says, or a district court comes out and says, yes, the statute says any permissible, any statutorily referenced valuation establishes actual cash value as a matter of law, I suspect that's what every insurer in Louisiana is going to do. They're going to start picking the lowest permissible value because that's just the end result of that kind of judgment. That's why USAA doesn't do that in the status quo. It believes its obligation under the insurance contract is to pay the actual value of a comparable vehicle. So it requires looking at the unique condition of the vehicle. But if the federal district court comes out and says, no, you can pick whatever the lowest possible value is out there, I suspect we're going to see every insurer come and do that in the state, and that's going to lead to lots of insureds being underpaid, including insureds in the current class, which raises the
accuracy issues. Not if ultimately after the fact, then the condition adjustments are made. It just guarantees them you start at a legal point rather than you start at an illegal point.
Well, it depends on how the district court would sort of frame that. If they say, no, you can pick a guidebook value irrespective of condition because NADA, none of the guidebooks sort of address the unique condition of a vehicle. So if they say that value alone is sufficient, right. Then it's just going to be, let's race to the bottom here. But if they say that value alone is sufficient, if you account for condition, well, then we're in the world of individualized inquiries as to determine the actual condition and value of each class member's vehicle.
What's your response to Prince's statement that Judge Kane has already decided that whatever difference there is between the computations in Slade and what CCC is like, he's already resolved that it is workable in this case, that you say it can't be added or subtracted to Kelley Blue Book and whatever, but the district court has already decided, which I guess would be a matter of fact, that it is proper. So how can we deal with that, or is it the wrong premise?
So I think the district court's opinion didn't actually say, didn't make a factual finding that taking CCC condition adjustments, putting it on top of NADA values, will create accurate vehicle values. If you read page 17 and 18 of the judge's opinion, Judge Kane's opinion, he cites out all USAA's evidence, and then he says, well, this is a merits question. We don't need to decide at the class certification stage. And we think that's a legal error, because without a finding that there's a common proof, a class-wide measure to account for condition, then there's no way to determine to whom USAA is liable in the class.
Did the Companion Shields case get to the standing issues at all?
The Companion Shields case also briefed the standing issues, and it's also up to the Fifth Circuit on a 23F petition. It has not been set for oral argument. I obviously can't say where that case stands, but it's.
What did the district court decide there? Did he take on the Sultana question?
So the district court actually, in a footnote, said, oh, Sultana's not applicable because Sultana doesn't address Article III standing. And that might be why it wasn't raised by plaintiffs to the district court, because Judge Kane had already sort of said, Sultana doesn't resolve any Article III standing issues. District court didn't address Sultana beyond that. Want to speak briefly about the Denny case plaintiff's counsel mentioned. That was a case about standing, not about the requirement for establishing breach of contract under Louisiana law. And what the Fifth Circuit actually said there was that the named plaintiff did not have standing. It said there was an injury in fact under the Supreme Court's, I'll butcher the name too, Uzabugnum case. And what Uzabugnum says is for the violations at issue in that case, there was nominal damages that plaintiffs had pled. And so, okay, nominal damages can give you the injury in fact. Under Louisiana law, under the elements of the cause of action, breach of contract still requires an injury. And in fact, standing is not dispensed in gross. You have to determine standing for each. So even if there was standing as to a breach of contract, which requires an element of injury, that doesn't mean they're standing for a 1973 violation.
All right, Kel.
Thank you, Your
Honor. I appreciate the presentation that both sides have made this morning.